Well, our connection this hour is made in the relationships between some of these demonstrators and police. And you have by now seen many, many videos of people on the street talking to officers, asking officers to kneel with them, to march with them. In some cities, officers have danced with them. We saw that in a city in the Midwest yesterday. Officers, the police department head signed a new agreement on conduct. And the moment the agreement was signed, demonstrators in the street asked officers to dance, and they did. And yet we've also seen some really rough confrontations. We have seen some ugly incidents. We've seen some criminal incidents. And I'm talking about on behalf of some police officers. Officers have been fired in some cities for reacting too violently or too aggressively. So it's a wide range, and it is a difficult moment for police, especially who are there on the front lines and might have some very, sort of differing views on these incidents. We want to bring in Marvin Stepherson, who is a retired police sergeant. He's an adjunct professor for criminal justice administration at Roberts Wesleyan College. And he retired as a police sergeant with 25 years of service in law enforcement, also retired as a dual service veteran of 27 years with the United States Marine Corps and the United States Coast Guard Reserve. Sergeant Stepherson, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me, brother. Definitely.
Can I call you Sarge, Marv?
You know what? Everybody does. I don't even remember my first name half the time.
How are you these days?
I'm well. I think probably as much as anybody can really say, between the adjustment for the pandemic and then, I don't think we can ever get, and nor should we ever get, normalized to the amount of violence that has taken place in our culture and our community.
Do you, let's do this here. We're going to kind of have a wide range of conversation this hour, Marv, about your career, maybe how you see things changing or where things need to go. But, I want to start by asking you if you've been out or you would go out and join those kind of demonstrations now.
Well, absolutely. I got to say yes, because the fact that before I became all those other titles that you named, and you got it accurate, man. It was awesome. I was a black man. I am a black man. I've never stopped being a black man. So growing up in the inner city, our community was filled with other young black men and women like myself playing on the playground, dreaming of doing, things that our families would be proud of. So, certainly when it comes to the celebrations, I think we all can do that universally. But when it comes to the trials and the the tribulations that we experience, I think culturally, we are unique in that own element. And so, if you ask the Hasidic Jews or any Jewish community member about the Holocaust, they're going to tell you whatever it is that is connected to that, they're going to demonstrate in a unified fashion. And so we've seen over the years from the Reconstruction to civil rights to now that anytime there is a person of color, specifically black, that has been, marginalized or dehumanized and wounded or killed, we come together tribalistically to protest the loss or the abuse because we all, at the end of the day, benefit if that change happens, just like those other communities like you're just mentioning, again, off the top of my head, the Jewish community, because that's the closest thing that I can think of right now. We talked about Holocaust and tribulations and, of course, the Native Americans. The internment camps with the Asian Americans. There's quite a few communities that have suffered. And then Hispanic and Latin communities also are right there with us. So to march, yes, I would definitely go out and march, because it's about bringing awareness for change for not just myself, but for my family, my kids, who are young adults now.
Marv, what made you want to be a Marine and what made you want to be a police officer?
Interesting enough, I think the police part probably was the easiest one, because I grew up, watching SWAT and Dragnet, so I remember out there on the lot with the other kids playing cops and robbers. I think all the boys can remember doing that. And we had some girls that came in, too, that wanted to join us. So I don't want to be sexist in my response. You know, the Marine part came about because I had a cousin that I looked up to. You know, he was like a big brother to me, and I'm the oldest of four brothers in my family. But I didn't have anybody older than I. And he was like that big brother to me, and he went into the Marine Corps. And you know, and as I was reaching my senior year in high school, I was looking to try and go and try my hat at being an athlete. You know, I was playing football at East, and so I wanted to see if I would, you know, make it in that arena. And just before the graduation and everything, my cousin was killed in a training accident. And so as a tribute to him, I pondered it, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to go and be a part of the Marine Corps, man, just to attribute to his life, because he was just that inspirational to me. And I'm glad I did. It was life-changing. It was building me as a man to really, I guess, prepare me to go into law enforcement.
Do you feel that it's a different situation now? Do you think if you were growing up right now, you would feel any differently?
Wow, that's a great question. I can't say that I have any regrets. Born in, 66, you know, so I was like right in the hotbed time of the civil rights. I can remember family members, man, who were part of the Panthers. You know, so we talk about, Tupac saying that his mom and dad were, you know, Panther members and doing the curriculum and the literature and the movement meetings and whatnot. You know, I'm not that far off from that. My mom wasn't a leader or nothing like that, but I had family members that came to her home and would discuss or talk about, you know, that. So I'm very much aware of the Panther movement and what it was doing in the Black community, and it did not match the narrative that I heard in law enforcement or even in academics or any setting, you know, talking with other white friends and neighbors, you know, it was always a negative blight to it. And it really was, I think, a mishandled topic when we talk about what the Panther movement was really about in the Black community. So to say that, you know, would I want to grow up now? It's tough because I don't think a lot of our young kids, young people really, are getting the true, the narrative of community like it was when I was coming up. We seemed a lot closer as a people then, even during that struggle. And now, you know, our young folk seem a little bit fragmented. I mean, you know, some of the movements that you see, they look really organized and they look really strong, and I think it's coming around. I won't totally demonize it and say it's not, but I really do feel that our young folk aren't as devoted to one another like it was when I was coming up.
Talking to Marvin Stefferson, who is a retired police sergeant and an adjunct professor for criminal justice administration at Roberts Wesleyan College, and I want to listen to four different clips. These are all recorded during recent protests and demonstrations in different cities. And to me, they're just examples of what some of the dialogue sounds like up close when these people who are feeling a lot of pain can actually get a chance to talk face to face with a police officer. Because often, you know, you don't get a chance to talk up close. And police officers sometimes are prohibited from speaking to the media or asked not to. But sometimes in these demonstrations, everyone is right up close to one another. So the first one is in Rochester, documented last Saturday by journalist for the Democrat and Chronicle, Will Cleveland. A Black man named Sadiq Muhammad was on the street talking in this clip to a Black Rochester police officer. Let's listen.
Look, you might see ignorance, but we look to y'all. Whenever I see a Black police officer, I feel a lot safer, for the most part. For the most part. But I just want you to know that, bro. We look to y'all and hold the other officers accountable, man. Because you, as a part of this, You are a part of this, bro. Whether you feel like it or not. No, you. As a people, as an African diaspora, brother. I'm just saying. I understand it. I understand. I'm just saying. I appreciate you. All right.
I want to put a pin in that one. He said, whenever I see a black police officer, I feel a lot safer for the most part. I mean, he's clearly not saying that's the perfect solution. But, Marv, how often did you hear sentiments like that from the black community?
Well, where do we begin with this? Really, when I listen to that, you know, I think about, like I said before, we're tribal. So there is that connection, you know, when you see a black teacher in front of your classroom, that's a connection for a young black male, you know, that could be a father, uncle, brother, sister. So in the community, to see an officer of color come into your neighborhood, there is that sense of connection. I mean, that's why white police officers police differently in the white communities or predominantly the rural or neighborhoods where they see one another, because that white officer sees that young white male or female like their son or daughter or niece or nephew. There's that tribal connection. So definitely having that black and brown face, male, female, in our community brings some reassurance. The disconnect is that the culture of law enforcement has not been addressed, not in the academy, not in any of the annual training that they go through for, revising or either a retraining of things that you learned before just to keep you, proficient in your craft. They need to add that. And really, when you add that cultural relevant component in law enforcement, when you add it in the educational institutions, you don't only just educate black and brown people, you educate all of our people, all of the white, Asian, again, Latin, because now we're talking about culture. So that way a white officer can walk into a black community and feel just as at ease as if they walked into a predominantly white community, because they know more about the community, and now they know how to speak, how to act in a way that would garner trust, okay? And that has not been what law enforcement has was constructed for in the United States, okay? They started out, we talk about the true history of it, they started out as the Patty Rollers. They were the part of that extension of the slave patrols and keeping black people subjugated to slavery and to forced labor. And so that culture really hasn't been addressed. And so now you have the police departments inside the community, and the black officers act like the white officers because they're emulating the culture of law enforcement. And so I hear what that young brother was saying. I hear what the black officer was saying, because I've been in those shoes, you know, walking in a neighborhood and having to say, hey, you know what? I understand the history of law enforcement, but I'm not here about that. I'm going to do my job, but I'm also here to educate. All right. I'm also here to mentor and to speak words of encouragement and wisdom to my community, because I want to see you rise up and be better than what you are. So that's my perspective of that conversation.
Now let's listen to the three other clips we have. The first one, and these are shorter clips and just kind of a sampling of some of the kinds of conversations we're hearing on these protest lines. This is in New York City, a New York City officer who is black.
These have been very chaotic nights, and that's why I took a knee, all right? If I could take a knee with the community to garner and broker peace, then I'll get on my knee every day.
Here's Atlanta. This is a black police officer speaking in Atlanta.
I have a son who's 31. I've got a son who's 15, all right? And I have to have these conversations with them all the time. So we're not telling y'all to leave. What was going on up here was wrong. That's why we brought it to a stop. The loudspeaker, the yakking and the yapping. We said pause. Let these people remain here. Let them stay in the street. Let them express their grievances, because you have a right to be pissed off.
And in Michigan, this is actually in Flint, but it is the county sheriff, a white man, who... you might have seen the longer clip. This is a shorter clip of him explaining why he decided to take off some of his heavier gear, set the baton down.
We want to be with y'all, for real. So I took my helmet off, they laid their batons down. I want to make this a parade, not a protest. You got little ones here, you got dogs, so what's up?
All right, so that sheriff then marched with those demonstrators. You heard the New York City officer say, I'm taking a knee with you. Marv, in moments like this, I'm seeing a wide range of reactions. If I share a piece of video like that on my social feeds, I will have people say, yes, more of this, please, more of this. Let's see those officers dancing with people. Let's see the officers kneeling, marching, putting their arms around. And then I'll have people say, that's just propaganda. The only real change is policy reform, and police are trying to make themselves look good in those moments. That's just propaganda. I'm hearing everything. Where do you come down when you hear and see pieces of video like that?
I love that because that's situational awareness. You know, you got to understand what is going to de-escalate a situation. You know, listening, active listening to people. People are saying, we want to see the humanity in law enforcement, okay, in the officers that serve and protect. We want to see it because when we watch that 8.5, 9 minute video of that officer's knee on that black man's neck, that was a symbolic, gesture of what the oppression has been for black people in this country for years. Is that oppression has been on our neck, and the callousness of the look and the behavior has been the same. Well, the person should have obeyed and they should have complied and they would have survived the encounter. There's no humanity in the response. All right, because I get the same thing that you get on your social media. I have had officers try to justify, you know, situations like Tamir Rice. He was shot in the playground with a toy gun. Mm-hmm. And the justification was, well, an officer was killed a week before or a month before on that same playground. So we are to now be excessive in our force because some violence or something happened in the neighborhood. You know, is that on every street? You know, because there has been violence or there's been some type of discord in every neighborhood. So now that's going to justify our overreaction. And so I applaud New York City. I applaud Michigan. I applaud, Atlanta and everywhere else that you have officers showing the humanity and being a part of the community where they came from. Right. We're just a sub community to the mainstream community. So the same challenges that you see us having as a broad community where we deal with race problems, where we deal with sex problems, you know, sexism, homophobia. When we look at all those same issues are inside the police department. They're inside the fire department. They're inside the medical community and the educational institutions. Like you mentioned before, I'm a retired police sergeant, but I also teach at the higher ed and, you know, teach at the K-12. And I have to be able to go in there and use, good judgment in how I address the students at each level because everybody's learning at a different level. And I can't reach them if I'm speaking to a K-12 at the academia level, or I can't go into a law enforcement or the medical community and speak a different language. I got to code switch. I got to be able to speak what is understood. Mm-hmm. And right now, in all those institutions, we're lacking representation in body, meaning the numbers, and in the culture as well, so that others will understand and won't just have these assumptions or stereotypes.
Talking to Marv Stefferson, a retired police sergeant who had 25 years in law enforcement and retired as a sergeant, and his service extends in a lot of different directions. Marv now is teaching in higher ed. He's an adjunct professor for criminal justice at Roberts Wesleyan, but he's also someone who offered 27 years of service with the United States Marine Corps and the United States Coast Guard Reserve. And wanted to have him on the program because I think Marv is one of the really thoughtful, careful voices in this community. Frankly, the kind of man that I look at my son and I would love for him to grow up to be a kind of person that I see Marv as in this community, who served but who understands pain and community suffering, comes from the community and wants to help in different ways, wants to be constructive and build, and I think understands the challenge and the complexities of these issues. After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about a couple of different issues that I'd love to get his take on. When he talks about the way officers have to, you know, they could justify some actions with fear. Well, that's one of the reasons that there's a call nationally to end qualified immunity for police. And that essentially means just because an officer can claim they felt scared or mistake something, an officer recently, I think this week, shot someone, and I got to be careful. I don't know where this happened. There's a lot happening this week. Shot someone after seeing a hammer in the waistband, thought it was a gun. It was not a gun. Shot someone. I mean, that's a mistake, but should you be able to sue officers for that? The Supreme Court basically says no, and there's a movement to change that, to hold officers accountable for those mistakes, sometimes based on fear or other bad information, sometimes based on bias or stereotyping. We're going to talk about the governor's comments. He says the looters are not protesters and police ought to arrest and hold them accountable. And we're going to talk about this Pew Research study from 2017 that I think is one of the most important aspects of understanding policing right now. And we'll get back to that in just a moment with Marv Stefferson. Coming up in our second hour, the fight over the Board of Elections feels like inside political baseball, but it affects a lot of people. There are June 23rd primaries and a special election coming up, and Democrats have not selected a permanent commissioner of elections. It's a big deal. There is some real opposition within the party, and we're going to find out why and what it's all about next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So, Marv Stefferson, there's this call to end qualified immunity, and it's coming from a lot of different quarters in this country. Starts with the federal level and a congressman named Justin Amash, who is a longtime Republican who recently became a Libertarian, opposes President Trump, thought about a run for president. He's not going to run as a Libertarian, but he is leading this national call in Congress to end qualified immunity. You're seeing a lot of support for it among Democrats, Republicans, and otherwise. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
Can you elaborate?
I'm sorry, I got distracted here. Let me hear that one more time, Evan.
All right. So when we talk about qualified immunity, this idea that police officers, they can make a mistake. The mistake could result in violence or death for someone. But if they can say, you know, I was scared or I made a mistake, that person, I thought they had a gun, they didn't, or I thought Tamir Rice had a gun, he didn't. And because of that, the Supreme Court has said it's a unique kind of job, and you can't sue an officer in that case. And Congressman Amash, among others, says that gives police a blanket immunity that the rest of the population doesn't have, and maybe leads to carelessness and more violence unnecessarily. So let's end that immunity. Let's end qualified immunity. Do you think that makes sense?
Right. So I was saying absolutely, because I was actually trying to pull that back up again. I looked at it earlier. Somebody had sent me the article, and so I was trying to look that up again, because what I wanted to speak to was that, you know, again, as somebody that served 25 years in law enforcement, I know that, a thing that I used to tell them also all the time, I say, good officers make mistakes, bad officers make excuses. When you make a mistake, you know, it's going to tell. You're going to be able to see the honest, intentions. And usually people will accept and own it and apologize and make amends for it. But when we see the bad officers, we see those out there that are doing these other things that are not becoming of the uniform or the badge, and they make excuses and double down to justify it. I think those are what the laws, the legislation, they're looking to try and make the amendment and change it. I think that's where it's applicable, and that's where it should be applicable. You don't want somebody in here doing things and doubling down on it when it's not right, and they know it's not right. And so those individuals have hid themselves amongst good officers and have soiled the entire community because of that. And so it's going to take legislature like that to help the good officers stand up, because now they have support. They have laws that will hold people accountable. The unions, the police departments will start to say, what's the priority? Is it going to be paying out money that's going to break our organization? Or are we going to start holding folks that are doing things that are not mistakes, but excuses? Mm-hmm. accountable for that. So that's why I said absolutely early, and I still stand by that.
Okay. Governor Andrew Cuomo says the looters are not the protesters. These are different movements. He says the protest movement is legitimate. It is righteous. It ought to be supported. There is a group of people, a smaller group, but they are taking advantage of this moment to loot, to steal, to destroy businesses. And he says the police have to step up and stop this while also respecting the protesters. And he says the looters are criminals, pure and simple. Do you agree with the governor on this?
I think that the governor, sees the looters in the same lens that many white Americans see it. And that is that what you have is trauma. You have years of trauma and other things that explain or at least give insight to why these individuals are out there doing that. Now, are there agitators and folk that are out there doing things? Absolutely. And I think there are individuals that are doing things that bring a negative light and make it seem as if it was this one particular community looting and destroying, when it's actually folk out there doing things purposely to make it look like that. Now, I will not justify anybody looting and stealing, taking stuff that people have worked hard for to build their business. That's not, right. That's not acceptable behavior. I wasn't brought up that way. But I won't demonize individuals that are acting out of trauma over the years of having nothing, okay, and seeking to get, but they don't receive, the aid or the assistance or the things that they need to make just life, comfortable or livable. So what you're seeing is people acting out of frustration, anger. They don't know another way to express. And then you have others taking advantage of that. And so I think that's what the governor was trying to speak to. Again, it's hard to really wrap your brain around and explain something if you're not a part of that community or a part of that injury, that trauma. And I think Dr. Joy DeGruy talked about it when she said post-traumatic stress. She gave a great title to that because she said doctors would look at veterans who would come back from war and they would exhibit these types of mental and physical scars from combat. And the doctors and the ERs who worked in those environments saw the same type of behaviors from children who lived in cities where they had high gang violence. The kids constantly coming into the ERs, shot and stabbed. And the difference they saw between those kids and the veterans was that the veterans came back out of combat. The kids, after they were bandaged and fixed up, they went right back into the community where they came from, where the injury continues. And so that scar tissue builds and builds mentally and physically. So these kids are now mentally and physically numb to what is actually right and wrong. Mm. And they go out and act out when they feel they have been attacked.
Well, I want to turn to this Pew study that I think needs to stay central here, because my concern, Marv, is that police officers generally, especially white officers, but generally police officers, are out of step with the general population when it comes to thoughts about race. Here's the Pew study. Pew asked a question: has the United States made the changes needed to give black people equal rights with whites? Yes or no? 92% of white police officers say, yes, the U.S. has done enough. We should have racial equality. We've done enough for black Americans. 92% of white police officers say yes. 57% of white people in general in this country say yes. So it's a 35-point gap between the white general population and the white police population. When it comes to the black population, 12% of black Americans say yes. That's the general population. Yes, enough's been done to give black people equal rights and opportunities with white people. 29% of black officers agree. So 17-point gap there. Still a lot more black officers would say yes than black people in general in this country, just as white, though it's obviously a different story with the overall numbers. Why do you think that is? Why is the police profession attracting people who think that, we should be post-racial, we've done enough, it should be over, way more than the general population? What do you What do you attribute that to?
Again, going back to education, when you look at, the individuals that say not enough has been done, they're probably still within that environment where they can see, the lack, right? And so many of the officers who join the police department, not many of them come from those communities. Because one, anybody that comes from that area is going to be like, I don't want to be a police officer. So the ones that do want to be police officers are folk like myself that grew up during a period wherein it really was a matter of being the change that you want to be. You go into the military or you go into a community where the mindset is a little bit more blended. And so now you see, both sides. Like I ran for County Ledge and I was able to walk in communities and have conversations with individuals, and they would give me different reasons why they vote one way or what they feel one way. And I understood that it was the socialization, okay? If you are socialized or conditioned to think a certain way or to feel a certain way, then it's very difficult for you to understand why 12% say not enough has been done, but 29 say it has, okay? And then that 29 is in a social setting where 92% say we've done enough, all right? And so if you take that 92 and you give them the middle passage instruction in high school and middle school, and you show them the images of slavery, or you talk about the stories like the spies of Mississippi where you had government-sanctioned spying on individuals who were going to church or joining the NAACP or who wanted to vote, and you saw that the state was spending money on keeping them, being black people, from voting, and if they thought about or wanted to vote, they would lynch or do some type of terroristic behavior. This was all sanctioned by the state, not the federal, but the state level. And so when you expose that type of behavior from a government level, then I think that 92 starts to say, well, maybe, I need to check my moral compass. But a lot of those 92 has not been exposed to that. They've been taught a lie about their government and about their educational system, okay, and the community that they come from versus the community that they go in and police. And so now that lie is more believable than the truth. And that's why those numbers are like that. I've had officers reach out to me now after they've had conversations with me or they've heard statements that I made in social media, and they go, I just didn't know that. I didn't understand that. I didn't know you experienced that. And that's why this George Floyd video is so powerful, because you saw what black community has been talking about for years that nobody believed. And that's what's going to change that 92% number, because now they believe. And there's no way you can dismiss what you saw.
Well, and maybe that's a good way to start to head toward the end of the hour here. You may say there's no way to dismiss it, and I am glad that I'm not hearing people dismiss the George Floyd murder. But, I mean, the former sheriff of Monroe County, Patrick O'Flynn, couldn't tell me that Philando Castile was murdered or that anything had been done wrong in that case, that he couldn't even say that the officer who shot Philando Castile 7 times during a stop, also in Minnesota, had misstepped at all. So, yes, George Floyd seems to be this moment where just about everyone can agree. But there's others that seem pretty close to certain that yet somehow don't elicit certainty. What is the leadership that's going to be required here? And where are you finding leadership right now, Marv?
Well, I feel fortunate about being in Rochester. I think Monroe County has been blessed with the current leadership of the sheriff and the city chief and the mayor. And the reason why I say that is because those are individuals that are approachable. Okay, they're willing to sit down and listen. And as you saw from the previous sheriff, he wasn't approachable. He didn't want to listen to his own people, let alone to the community when they talked about, the racial strife that was going on in the county. He was just, he practiced cognitive dissonance, okay, as much of the white community has done for years. They found ways to excuse in their mind why Philando Castile died. Okay, they used every excuse in the book to justify what they saw, because they just didn't want to believe what the black community was saying, was that you can't sit at home and eat ice cream without being killed. You can't sleep in your bed without being killed. You can't go watch birds in the park without being accused. Okay, you're weaponizing your skin color. Okay, so the leadership that we have here, you know, Sheriff Baxter, I worked with for years in RPD, and we've done some work together in diversity. He's there. He's not perfect, but he is there, and he's open hearted. He'll listen. And he empathizes and understands that there's got to be changes. And that's what you need. You need leaders that are willing to change, willing to own when they're not right, and willing to change. And that's why I said earlier, you know, mistakes. Good people, good officers, they make mistakes because they're willing to change. Bad people, bad officers, they make excuses because they want to double down and dismiss and justify their wrong.
Well, in our last 30 seconds, is this a national emergency with the leadership from the White House?
Absolutely.
You didn't need 30 seconds.
I sure did.
Yeah, and Marv, I mean, I know you got involved in electoral politics this year. You've run for office. I know you were a delegate in the Democratic primary. But you're also not someone who is, you know, the most overtly political person I've ever met. I don't ask that question to sort of bait, but I think we need to call the moment what it is and try to be clear-eyed about a range of solutions, but also define the problem. And that's why I ask, and I'm not surprised it only took you 1 second to answer it, but I'm glad you were taking the time for us here. Listen, someday soon we'll be able to see each other in person, and I look forward to that again. It's always good to see you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for what you do for this community and for sharing your insight, and Here's to real progress and peace ahead.
Amen to that.
Marvin Stefferson is a retired police sergeant and teaches higher ed, very much involved in our community, sharing his thoughts and experience. Short break, more connections coming up.